Grace and peace unto you from God the Father and our Lord Jesus Christ. Please open your Bibles to the last chapter in the letter to the church at Ephesus, the encyclical that circulated all through Asia Minor at the end of the 5th century. In these years after, toward the conclusion of Paul's third missionary journey, he was imprisoned and he wrote Ephesians, Colossians, and Philemon at the same time, and at a different moment, he wrote Philippians. These are the so-called prison epistles, although we could include 2 Timothy in that category as well, though it is classified as a pastoral epistle. And in this moment, he's doing basically here what he did on a grander scale when he wrote to the Romans. He's offering a compendium of his perspective and points of emphasis for believers. So when we turn to chapter 6, beginning with verse 10, we've been through five previous chapters of extensive explanation and profound discovery on reconciliation. The first five chapters of Ephesians could be called a white paper on reconciliation. If we reduce it down to one single point, it's unity. He's big on the singular, one this, one that, one faith, one baptism, one church. All the barriers are broken in our oneness. Everything that would naturally separate us has been abrogated. And there's a lot to separate us. Age and gender, language, culture, time and place. But regardless of our differing talents and gifts and roles, there's still just one church and one body, because there's one faith, and we all share in the mystery of this liberation that the Lord has provided for us. And so as we come to this point, we've been acutely aware that Paul has illustrated and accented the power of God that's operative from creation to salvation. The same Lord that made something out of nothing has saved us from sin and death. And this victory over evil is a divine power that we need in our lives beyond our conversion. Now, it's important to understand that when we receive salvation, naturally we're empowered and strengthened, and we think of how much the Lord has changed us, which is true, but of course it doesn't stop there. This divine power in reconciliation and redemption foreshadows what we need for our daily life, for our discipleship, for our followership. What's happened to us in conversion must continue to happen within us as we live. We rely on the Lord to transform us from the old person to the new self. We know we don't do that. He does it. In the same way, we must depend upon Him for our daily devotion. In fact, maybe we could always summarize that in all the letters, not just Paul's, but all epistles of the New Testament, there's underlying them all, this quest for a deepening of devotion, of what we can do to grow in the Lord. In this particular case, though, as we see when we read verses 10 to 17, Paul will instruct us and forewarn us that there's an upcoming campaign of battles, that as we walk in the Lord in the power of His might, that we will need a holy arsenal against an old adversary. And the mandated solution comes from the same holy source that transformed us and gave us our deliverance from sin and death. So we begin in verse 10, Ephesians 6, and we'll read through 17. Now finally, become empowered in the Lord and the might of His strength. Be clothed in the panoply of God, in order that you might be able to stand against the methods of the devil. Because for us, the struggle is not against blood and flesh, but rather against rulers, against authorities, against world powers of this darkness, against the spiritual entities of evil in the heavens. Now, because of this, undertake the panoply of God in order that you might be able to resist in that evil day, and having accomplished all things, to stand. Stand, therefore, having been enveloped about your waist in truth, having been clothed in the breastplate of righteousness, having strapped your feet in preparation of the gospel of peace. And additionally, having hoisted the shield of faith, by which you will be able to quench all those flaming darts of evil, and receive the helmet of salvation and the sword of the Spirit, which is the utterance of God. May the Lord bless the reading of His Word. There are three mandates in the very first part of this, and naturally all of us want to run to that metaphor of armament. I do too. I'm intrigued by that. It's poetic, it's uplifting, it's inspiring, it's creative. All of those imageries from the Roman soldier. But Paul doesn't start with that. He starts with the reason we need the armament. Well, what causes us to go into the battle in the first place? And he offers three simple mandates before we even get to those attributes. First one, he says, become empowered in the Lord. Empowerment of the strong and capable. Empowerment sounds like a power play. We always talk about empowering ourselves, or how special interest groups want to seek empowerment. And of course, this is part and parcel of the self-help mentality. Now, if we were to read it that way, we could paraphrase and say, Annie, get your gun and take charge. But that's not what this means. And not to get too cute by half about the grammar, but this is a deponent verb that carries with it a middle voice message or meaning or translation. It's not you empower yourself, but rather become empowered. The might of His strength, not yours. Otherwise, we'd read it as simply, why don't you just buckle up here, bow up, and strengthen up. Bulking up. But no, this is a matter of us allowing the Lord to impart and impute and otherwise install His strength in us. The might of His strength, not yours, not mine, not ours. And so once again, we see that Paul's hearkening us back to Jesus' victory over evil and death, and how this is repeated continually in the life of the believer. But we will often find ourselves blocking this empowerment, this capability, this strengthening, this enabling. That word is often negative, but in this case, it's quite positive. Become enabled by the Lord. Nigh the strength of His might, not enabling others to make excuses and to evade consequences, but you become enabled by the Lord, by His power and His presence. Me, to allow His strength to permeate and be my strength. The second mandate is to become clothed. You notice that word I used, panoply? That is the literal transliteration, the literal word from the Greek in the English. Look it up. And it means full armor. It comes from the word full or all, and it comes from the word armor. And you know it indirectly if you've read about Greek society, the hoplite soldiers. They had this massive body shield. They had a sword or a knife. They might have a bit of a face guard, but a helmet. They had boots. But the hoplite soldier was the one who stood in a phalanx, shoulder to shoulder to shoulder, and went into battle. And they didn't go anywhere without that panoply, that full armor. And Rome appropriated that imagery and that language. In fact, Rome is nothing but a sponge for Greek culture. Everything Greek was good with them. And so now with their armies even, they use Greek vocabulary, Greek imagery. Paul's now, as you know, on house arrest at best, or he's in a dungeon at worst. He's been around Roman soldiers forever. He knew them as a boy out in Tarsus, not often, but would see them. Remember, he's a Roman citizen, so he's operative in what we now call Italian, but it's Latin. Spoke Greek out in the diaspora, read Hebrew, spoke Aramaic, and who knows whatever the other dialects he might have absorbed. But in all of that, he was acutely aware of his Roman identity as well as his Jewish. And the Roman identity would have been particularly branded by the appearance of a soldier. And they were quite a sight, all dressed up in their armament. They were from heel to head and back down to heel again with their accoutrements. It was quite a spectacle. And now he's in prison, and he's being surrounded by Roman guards. Now, they may not be in full regalia every day, every time he sees them, because they weren't actually going out into battle, but he was aware of their gear. And he saw them suiting up. And he says to them, "Be clothed, you all, be clothed." And once again, it's useful not to be too cute by half, but to note the grammar. This isn't just clothe yourself, but also be clothed. And it's a little bit kind of interesting. We know this and we do it automatically. We don't even think about it, but we understand the middle voice quite well. I wash my hands. I comb my hair. I brush my teeth. I'm the agent of action as the subject, but I also am the recipient of the action. There's a direct object there, but it's coming to me too. And so it's like a boomerang. The action goes out from the subject through the verb, and then it comes right back to the subject. That's called middle voice. So you clothe yourself. Of course, you're the recipient of the clothing, not somebody else. When you wash your hands, you don't put them in the dishwasher and turn it on. You wash your own hands. You're the subject of your own action. So, now then, be clothed. Clothe yourself. Now, just your part is to accept what the Lord is going to give you for not decorative purposes, but for warfare. Be clothed is accurate because that's not your clothes, that's His clothes that He gives to you. Remember, the strength of His might, not yours. These are His properties that He's imparting to us. Be clothed like a good old hoplite soldier before battle. Remember, all that gear is on loan from heaven. It's yours to use, but it's not yours. You didn't make it. You didn't fabricate it. You didn't design it. It's by the bequest of the Lord. And it's essentially necessary in order to stand against the methods of the devil. Now, that's translated wiles. And there's nothing wrong with that translation, the wily devil. But that's kind of comical to us anyway. You know, like Wile E. Coyote, beep, beep. You know, it's like the devil's really clever. And man, it's a real fun game. It's like a board game. I think like beating. But the literal word there is method. It's the same word in English, methodes. You know, that we get that word out of it, out of Greek. The methods are neutral. They may be good, they may be bad, of course. That word in and of itself is not negative or positive. It's just describing the means or the agency or the particular manner of an action. But now then, it's being used by the devil. And you know how 1 Peter says the devil's like a roaring lion. But he's more than that, of course. He's not just always barking like a dog or roaring like a lion, indifferent to camouflage. And sometimes he very much is like a serpent lurking in camouflage, hiding, ready to strike. We can describe our adversary in many ways. He's an obstructionist. He's an accuser and a prosecutor. He's a liar and a deceiver, but above all, he's the opponent of the holy. And that's the real purpose of this equipment, is to be prepared to stand against. In other places, the verb will be withstand, but right here, it's just to stand up and to maintain a rightful posture over and against this enabler, against this liar, deceiver, this accuser, prosecutor, this adversary, obstructionist. It's helpful as a caveat right now in parenthesis to remember that the devil is limited. He's got methods. He's got a lot of tricks up his sleeve. But as Flip Wilson would have said, he cannot make you do it. Now, those of us old enough to remember that comedy shtick, he actually said, "The devil made me do it." And we all knew that he was making an excuse for himself in the comedy, that in point of fact, he was trying to diffuse his own blame. But we often will do the same thing for real. Oh yeah, the devil made me do that. It's his fault. He's all over me. Like white on rice. Like butter on bread. Oh really? So the devil's omnipotent, omniscient, omnipresent? So the devil's sovereign? I don't think so. No, he can bother you. He can create a lot of problems, as we see in this passage. He's got methods that will ruin us. But he's limited. He cannot defeat the armor of God. He cannot defeat the Lord Almighty. He's being allowed to have this time at the discretion of the sovereign Lord himself. He is dangerous. And that's why we need this full panoply of God, this armor of God, the power of God unto salvation, this that will give us victory continually, not just from our moment of conversion, but in our life of salvation. And so now, Paul moves toward that panoply, and he says, you've got to remember the reason why you need it is because it's the Lord's strength that empowers you, and it's the devil's torment that causes us to stumble. For the struggle to us is not against flesh and blood, we would say. Did you notice that Paul reversed the order? He just did it to catch our attention. It's blood and flesh. Out in the Old Testament, it's always flesh and blood, and Hosea and the like. And now he just sort of turns it around just so you notice and not fall into the trap of hearing it as a cliche. And he makes a startling statement here. Our struggle, sometimes called our battle, our fight. You know, the word actually comes from wrestling match. It means that our engagement and our tussle. I like that tussle, but it sounds a little bit weak. It is a tussle. But, you know, I can tussle with Mendesu and it's a lot of fun. It's not really a problem. But, you know, to battle, to wrestle. I grew up in Tulsa, Oklahoma. Did you know that wrestling outdrew basketball in the winter? Amazing. Those people are nuts. Oklahoma State, Oklahoma, Iowa, and Iowa State are the capitals for wrestling in this country at collegiate level. If you like it, fine. It is an interesting sport, and it's terrifying if you've ever tried it. I was actually the right build and size to be a wrestler, but I just hated it. I didn't want to grapple with any guy on the mat. You read into between those lines anything you want. But that's the way I felt about it. I didn't. And also, I'm a bit claustrophobic. And when you're pinned down, you can't get up. And it's horrible. It is arguably one of the most brutal sports around. It's far more, causes far more exertion, maybe not as much damage, but more exertion than boxing, than running. It's the most six intense minute of your life. The only thing close to it is speed swimming. In terms of an aerobic, it will devastate you and me. And when he says this is like a wrestling match, people's eyebrows go up and they go, wow, that's tough. That's tough sledding. You know, this isn't some little dancing game of boxers, of hit and miss and skirting around, skipping here and there. Oh, no. This is being in the throes, in the grasp, in the clutches of evil. For ours, he says, is not a wrestling match against blood and flesh. Because if it were, it would have a demarcation, it'd be limited, and it'd be over. Win, lose, or draw. You have your moments of ups and downs, and on you go. It's not against blood and flesh. But instead, this hyperbole from Hebrew means it's an external attack that's beyond just mere flesh and blood. This is not some inner strife that you and I might suffer because of this spiritual warfare that's battling within the ramparts of our own soul. This is beyond us. We can go to that other issue of my own devotional life, my own interior life, on another occasion. Right now, Paul is focusing on what's coming at us from without, not within. And he says, you all need to understand, you can't appeal to your heroic Superman syndrome to win this battle. It's not just flesh and blood. This is not a winnable competition. But instead, and he now starts that list, rulers, authorities, world powers of this darkness, and spiritual entities of evil in the heavens. We notice the business about rulers and authority, and right now it'd be real tempting to take off on a cheap shot about governments or systems. And they are it is true, there are human systems of control and governance that may be quite evil, but they may be useful. We are always struggling in that balance between Romans 13 and Revelation 13, where the government is our aid and we pray for it, and where the government is our enemy and we battle against it. We're always in this gray zone between those two extremes. But when he now uses rulers and authority, he's not speaking about friendly elected officials. They could be neutral, they can be favorable, but what if they are vessels of the demonic? We need go no further in the Old Testament than Pharaoh and Nebuchadnezzar and Belshazzar to remember how bad these guys can be. And when he says our battle is against rulers and authorities, he does mean folks right here, right now, around us. But what makes them dangerous is that they are in evil alliance with the adversary. They have become minions of darkness. They are demonic. They may not recognize it themselves, and then again, they may be perfectly aware. But they are out to get us, and they are out to discredit the Lord. Their purposes are evil. They lie. They deceive. They abuse. They engage in sophistry and downright Orwellian language. Dark is light, light is dark, and so forth. These are the authorities, the rulers. And those words mean just what you think they mean. The rulers are whether they're elected or unelected. Dictators or presidents or prime ministers or governors. All of them alike. And these authorities, the ones around them, it may be the local mobster or it may be the neighborhood association. They're all got their little ranks and powers. But the problem is that they are in alliance with the evil one. And Paul makes that clear as he goes down the list. Our battle is not against blood and flesh, but against these folks who are in alliance with evil and these cosmic powers of this darkness. Now, there's no space force floating around the moon and Jupiter and Mars, so this isn't something out there that we don't know. This is what we do know. These are the principalities of the air. These are the spiritual powers of evil. These are the devil and the demonic. This is poetic language to describe exactly what we know to be Satan himself and his minions. The gloom and doom of the pagan astrologers always thought that humanity was being victimized by a malignant force. Paul's not buying into that, although he is using their language. Cosmic powers. It's not in the planets, mind you. It's in a real struggle against spiritual forces that are lurking behind all these earthly powers. These rulers and authorities are in an alliance, in allegiance with the evil one. And their dominion has been designed for our entrapment and harm. We are very much like sheep being left in the pasture of wolves. Remember now, your battle is even worse than that. He's accelerating the challenge here. It's not just against authorities and rulers, cosmic powers of this darkness, this very darkness, the one that we experience, the one we've known in the scriptures from beginning until now, the one that will continue until he returns and consumes history, but also, get this, spiritual entities of evil in the heavens. This will really confuse a lot of people because they think heaven is a place of only perfection. But you might recall that in Genesis 6, there were some rebellious spirits that came down to earth and tried to make mischief with our folks. And they did, and they were incarcerated in heaven after that. And 1 Peter describes this, that when Jesus died, that he proclaimed even to the spirits incarcerated in heaven. Now, it's a caveat. It's an exception to the overwhelming rule of divine perfection, of holiness. It's like a little carve-out. But the point that Paul's making is that there is evil that's permeated the entire created order. And that they are spiritual entities, and that's a noun that can be a person, a place, or a thing. And it's plural. It can be all those folks and all those places and all those things or vessels. And they are evil in their makeup, their composition. Nothing legitimate about them. They are pure evil and wickedness. And they're in the heavens and on earth. They're basically everywhere. They are nomadic and itinerant enemies, an invisible opponent. And now Paul gives the image of our battle, of our resistance to their constant counterattack. And we know why they're after us, because they've been dethroned. Because they have no place. They've been exiled, excommunicated, booted, and now they're going to take it out on us. That's the imagery. Paul's playing right into the cosmology of the Old Testament and the New, making it very clear that science doesn't answer all our questions. That we're in a spiritual warfare. And these things are beyond us. And they're insidious. And so, what do we do? Before we, next week, go down to the brass tacks of the armament, look at what Paul says was his third mandate. He told us to become empowered by the strength of His might. This is the Lord's force that makes us go. He says to be clothed in the panoply, the full armament of God, to remember is what He provides for us. That wonderful word to describe the Lord Himself as providence, that He gives to us what we need to sustain our march. And then He says, stay put. Stay put. Just stay. It translates literally to stand, and that's true. But to stand is not to move. It's just to stay put. You know that. And you know, it kind of goes against my instincts. I'll bet it does yours too. Don't just stand there. Do something. Well, how about the opposite? Don't just do something. Stand there. Don't move around. Don't shift. Don't slide. Don't retreat. Stand there. To stand is to be capable to withstand in that evil day, he says. If you stand there in the full panoply, the armament of God, you will be able to withstand, to resist in that evil day. And we don't need to think of it as 24 hours, but of any moment. That day is any time that the battle is engaged. This is a future crescendo of worsening onslaught. Let me say that again more dramatically. He's describing here what is a future crescendo, building, of the onslaught, not of ours against them, but theirs against us, that we might stand. Having accomplished all this, having produced this, not your salvation, but having done your part to become empowered and to be clothed, now then, having accomplished all this and having appropriated the armament of God, having done your obligation and your requirements, now you can presume, having executed your salvation with fear and trembling, exactly like Paul describes in Philippians. When you do this, you are working out your salvation. That's the same thing. This is more graphic, but it's the same thing. This is what we do to cultivate, sow, and develop our salvation. It's not ours, but it's His, but this is our part, our response. And I conclude today, we make note that we're soldiers on watch for dangers. That's what you and I are. This imagery, if we stay with it, puts us in the position of being soldiers who are on watch for dangers. And that can be very boring. Remember, being vigilant is a tedious task. It's not, sometimes there are moments of fascination and interest, but normally It is an uphill grind. It's against the stream. We'd rather have excitement and entertainment. But to be vigilant means to be on guard against that which is unpleasant. And we would much rather be involved with what's pleasant. Understandable. But that's why the mandate here can be boiled down to be resolute in the Lord. Paul's given us a mandate to buckle down and trust in providence, trust in the armament of God, trust in the power of His might. Don't do anything, just stand there. Avoid all the temptation to deploy worldly weapons against human enemies, when in point of fact our battle is against spiritual powers and principalities. That's like fighting a nuclear war with butter knives. Don't do it. Stand there. Stay there in the power of God, in the heavy armament of His resources, because our battle is not against these little pop guns of rulers and authorities, but against the real forces of evil. So now we understand again our call to persevere, not just with our own might, our own strength, our own best efforts, but persevere with the heavenly resources against demonic forces. Perhaps it would be useful to consider the solid rock of our salvation. It doesn't move. It's just sitting there. Well, not sitting. It's standing there. Well, not just standing. It's immovable. It's permanent. It doesn't go. We flit around. We're a little bit skittish. But the rock of our salvation is truly immovable. And that's what He's calling us to be as His representatives. Immovable. Just like the rock upon which we stand. And that rock provides us with the source of our own strength and our own hope and our own victory, because Jesus is indeed Lord.